Good afternoon. On behalf of the steering committee of the Sexuality Colloquy and Michigan State University, we welcome you to our 19th all-university presentation in this series. As I suspect most of you know, we are implementing our theme, Sexuality, A Search for Perspective, and we have a particular orientation to give you this afternoon in the first of a series of three speeches. The Value Considerations for Moral and Ethical Decision Making. We will have two other all-university presentations implementing this subsection. This evening at 7 o'clock p.m. in this auditorium, Dr. Lester Kirkendall will speak on sex and human wholeness. Tomorrow afternoon at 4 p.m., also in this auditorium, Dr. Roy Menninger will speak on decisions in sexuality and active impulse, conscience, or society. Our topic this week concludes this term-long series and attempts to give a conclusion and perhaps a sense of wholeness to our theme. And although you perhaps have attended most of the other sessions, let me very quickly attempt to give you a bit of perspective. We began with the physiological aspects of human sexuality, then moved to cultural perspectives, sexual roles in American society, sexuality and the law, premarital sexual standards and behavior, marriage and the family. This colloquy series has perhaps been unique in the history of Michigan State University efforts that are cross-disciplinary and have involved students, staff, and faculty members in a rather unique thrust for this series of speakers, as well as innumerable dialogue contacts in residence hall units, small student group units, the student union sessions, and others. At this time, I'm pleased to present Mr. Peter Ellsworth, who will introduce our speaker. Peter Ellsworth is a senior, majoring in pre-law, a social science divisional major, and a member of the Honors College. He's been selected for membership in Excalibur, Omicron Delta Kappa, Blue Key, Green Helmet, and Phi Eta Sigma. Now, academic and service activities haven't taken all of his spare time, although I understand from Pete there's very little of the latter. He's an active member of Delta Tau Delta fraternity, and I think his most outstanding feature, the thing for which most students know and respect him, is the time and energy given to campus leadership and student government. He served as vice chairman of ASMSU last year and is currently chairman of ASMSU. I think it's no surprise, therefore, that he's also listed in Who's Who in American Colleges and Universities, and last year was the co-recipient of the James Stefanoff Award for the Outstanding Junior. Mr. Peter Ellsworth.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzgerald. Our speaker this afternoon is a nationally prominent theologian. He is currently the senior minister of the Second Congregational Church in Greenwich, Connecticut. He's a prominent teacher, management consultant, and counselor who was director of training for the American Foundation of Religion and Psychiatry in New York. He has served as a visiting professor of psychology at Oberlin Graduate School and also as a visiting lecturer at the Andover Newton Theological School. Currently, he is president-elect of the American Association of Pastoral Counselors, and he's a board member of the World Neighbors Incorporated. He received his BS degree, Bachelor of Sacred Theology, and doctoral degrees from Boston University, and he's done postdoctoral research at the C.G. Jung Institute in Zurich, Switzerland. He's married and has five children. His topic this afternoon is sex and the soul, and I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Otis Maxfield.
Excuse me a minute, I'll put this on. I preface my prepared comments with a couple of personal feelings about the short time I've been on campus. This morning, my two colleagues who will be speaking later and I met with about 40 people. There was a considerable age range, all students. We thought we had a generation gap. There were some women there that I would guess were in their 50s, although it's very dangerous to guess whether it's a woman or not, let alone how old she is now. We also had some young ones there, which in my 40-ish bracket looked awfully young to me. One of the things that moved me, however, was that it soon became obvious that we had a mind gap rather than a generation gap. For some of the older women with several children, some of whom were in their mid to late 20s, we're talking about how at the deepest level their attitude and behavior had undergone fundamental shifts since this colloquy's been underway. One who had come to review her idea about trial marriage, another who had come to take another look at premarital sex or sex out of wedlock, so to speak. I thought the candid kind of sharing and the thoughtful kind of assessment among the, quote, older group, without using that in a derogatory way, put to the test the younger ones who were present. I've not been in many places where the mind gap got bridged in such a significant fashion, and I hope you'll let more opportunities come when youth and age and mothers and virgins, one of our young ones said she was a virgin, as if that were a rare phenomenon in our culture, could have that kind of social intercourse together. The other one really doesn't have much profound to it, but I was interested that last night when I checked in, I rode the elevator up to the sixth floor to begin to walk to the seventh floor where the VIP suite is, which checks one's physical capacity. And a boy rode up with me and asked me what I was doing. I said I was checking in to be here for today. And he said, you know, he said, we got open housing up here now. And I said, what did that mean? And he said, well, you could have girls in your room. He said, you're going to have anybody up tonight? And I said, well, I hadn't thought about it, but I'll wait and see the room. And then he asked me what I was doing here, and I told him I was coming to be in this. And he said, well, I don't go to any of that stuff anymore. He said, I think sex is the one thing in which practice doesn't make perfect. He said, I've been getting worse and worse over the last 6 months. But he said, and I gave him that Rogerian O, and I knew he was going on anyhow. But it's one I hadn't heard in this whole area. He said, you hear the one about the little boy who came home from school and said to his mother, if I can get it straight, where did I come from? And she was caught off base and a little embarrassed, so she said, why, the stork brought you. And he took out a pencil and a paper and wrote it down. And then she felt trapped, and he said, by the way, where did you come from? And she said, the same place. He wrote that down. Then he said, where did grandmother come from? And she said, the same place. And he wrote it down and disappeared, and she hoped for good, I take it. And he came home the next day from school and said, you want to know what we did in class today? And the mother said, no. And he said, well, I'm going to tell you. He said, we had to write an essay on our family's development. And he said, I got an A. And he said, here's how mine began. There hasn't been a normal birth in our family for three generations. And I thought that as I've looked at the position papers and read the stuff that some of you put together and also read the taped, reproduced addresses of others, seems to me that you've had lots of normal things and some not so normal going on. I read one of those lectures and it sounded like a cheerleading team one of my daughters used to be on, only she'd say, give us an A and then give us an M. And you were repeating other words here. Thought I might say, give me a P and see how we could come out with that, or give me a V. What I'd like to talk about is sex in the soul. I don't like to read, but we're kind of stuck with who quotes and what's reproduced and where it is, so I'd like to read a bit but ad lib some. I have no intention of taking us more than 40 minutes or so. He who thinks by the inch and talks by the yard should be kicked by the foot, and I notice my own learning curve rapidly goes down after a half hour, unless I fabricate all sorts of fantasy interests. So I commend you to read all of this later when it's published, for it's written and footnoted and quotes and all the stuff that goes with it. There's a little book called Advice to a Young Wife from an Old Mistress. and I commend it strongly to you. Advice to a young wife from an old mistress. I want to begin with what the old mistress said, and I want to end with what she said, which in no way is to slander the wisdom of young wives. At one point, the old mistress gives this advice to the young wife. When my young friends discuss sex, they speak of it as being close to someone, or having something of my own, or making me feel special. This betrays an alarming spiritual and sensual void. It's an attempt to extract from sex the sense of unity and continuity that can only be poured into it. Taken in the abstract, sex is in no way glorious. Children, upon first hearing of it, spontaneously regard it as either squalid or absurd, and they are right. It acquires its character from us. Eroticism in or out of marriage cannot endow life with meaning. And sex retains its richness just as long as we bring meaning to it. When it is new to us, sex provides not only sensation, but a hint of wondrous realms beyond sensation, as does any other fresh intelligence. But like other newborn creations, an idea, a baby, a talent, a purpose, it requires to be developed. Sexual poise is not expertise, which is only a kind of proficiency in mechanics and may remain quite ignorant. Sensation and experience are not identical, and the muddled effort to make them interchangeable is one of the saddest of modern confusions. Feelings always accompany experience, but they do not constitute it. That is why any attempt to regain experience merely by repeating the sensation is doomed to failure and bitterness. In the sphere of sex, this results in the empty chase after gratification, else apathetic compliance with incidental physicality, both of which are immoral because they isolate and insult the body. Sexuality is lonely. Well, I'm convinced that what we got going on is a new kind of Puritanism. In the Victorian era, we had a kind of Puritanism which said, in effect, let's try to have love without sex. And I think in our era, a lot of what I see is another kind of Puritanism which says, let's try to have sex without love. And either form of Puritanism, it seems to me, sort of isolates the body from the rest of us. And no matter how we get drawn back to our animal ancestors, my perspective, with one foot in religion and one in psychotherapy, but also with one sense of my own being, tells me that I can't go back without getting dehumanized. And I can't go back to the model of my animal ancestors without striking a mortal blow at my own self-realization, which in the final analysis is my deepest longing, not the gratification of this or that instinct, or the having of this or that pleasure, or the reduction of this or that loneliness. My deepest longing is to be who I am, and then to live that with as much authenticity as I'm able. Well, in this kind of machine look then, we say, what is it that's gone on and what's taken place? For me, morality, not in any attempt to define it exhaustively, is not one particular set of human acts, but all human action. I know some thoroughly detestable people who've never been sexually promiscuous. And I know some awful people who've hardly had a juicy fantasy for years. You know what a problem righteousness can be, and there's no sense in beating that into the ground. A little girl who said, "Dear God, make all the bad people good and all the good people nice," knew what she was talking about. You know, Emerson said once, if I see someone coming at me indicating their only intent is to help me, I run like the Dickens in the other direction. We're all aware of this. And I think we also know that if you have to choose between an attractive sinner and a dried up saint, you know which way you vote. There is a kind of awful problem for righteousness. But be that as it may, morality then is not this or that thing. It's the whole range of way in which we relate. And I suppose for me, sexuality, which certainly begins in the cradle, is not only the act of intercourse or eroticism. It's that whole range of affectionate, intimate responses, which certainly have a root in the instincts, but seem to have another root in the spirit. And where these opposites come together is where one knows joy that lasts, an ecstasy that doesn't abandon, and a sense of being carried beyond the moment that is more than a trip which comes by some artificially induced method. Well, to look briefly back at the tradition out of which I come, for no one's done it before, and it was one of the suggestions in the requirement. It seems to me that the argument from Scripture is at least that somehow sexuality was assumed to be a part of the process of human nature. The Old Testament tells us over and over again that God looked on His creation and said, "Lo, it's good." We're reminded that He said to His people, "Be fruitful and multiply," but also said, "Subdue the earth and have dominion over it." Somehow to simply be the victim of nature was not to be a man's destiny. In fact, I was interested to note in preparing this that in the book of Deuteronomy, it's spelled out very clearly that a young couple who marry should let the man have a year's exemption from military service so that he can enjoy his sexual life. It might be an idea for us to give to General Hershey as we overhaul the draft law today and help some of us to make the most of the situation. We look at the New Testament, the famous statement of Jesus that the lustful look is equated with adultery. I think really taking in its broad context, it doesn't suggest that this Jew named Jesus wanted dried up people, but rather that he was trying to point to the fact that what really matters is the inner motivation. Like in psychotherapy, we seldom get stuck on the behavior. We want to look at the attitude that prompts the behavior. For most of us have not a performance problem. We have an attitudinal problem. And we know full well that in the complexity of our humanity, one can do the wrong thing for the right reason just as well as he can do the right thing for the wrong reason. And so the simplistic view leaves lots to be desired. We took it on through history. You know what happened to the thing with Augustine after 40 raucous years. He decided that all this should go away, which tells us that sex at least has progression, that if we want to come out voting for the monogamous way, we ought to begin by saying it's something to work toward, not a prerequisite of beginning, but otherwise we'd just be totally hypocritical. When we try to sum up the whole thing, I think we come from the official standpoint, which may not be the way it's operational, to the conviction that today, because I don't want to bore you with history, that the official Catholic position is still caught on the fact that the primary purpose of sex is for procreation. You've read the recent arguments, watched the creative forces of change and revolution, and from wherever you stand, you know the battle's on in the Roman Church. There's a great deal of merit in reminding us that one purpose in sex intercourse is procreation. That the position taken reflects a rather deterministic position of 3 centuries ago, suggests that it's not going to make it. By the same token, to deal with it respectfully, I think, is our task. If we look at the Protestant standpoint, to take two, don't have the Hebrew one, and I really wish I knew it better than I do. We at least see that some things emerge upon which is as much consensus as one can ever get from Protestants, for they're really quite a laissez-faire lot, and the Methodists never quite want to admit that the Baptists got something good going and vice versa, but it's able, I think, to pluck out 3 or 4 broad base premises that the official church position holds. For example, that man, because he's a whole or total being, that is, that he is mind and body, and that he is flesh and spirit, and that he is past and future, and that he is time and timeless, and that he is fantasy and fact, that the richness of the opposites have no limit to their amplification, that if we see a human being as more than his functions, but as a creature with all the richness that's implied in process theology, that sex is good if it fulfills his total being. That if sexual experience or activity, or I'd add fantasy, further fragments and disassociates and threatens with meaninglessness or guilt or anxiety that does no good, then somehow one has to take a look at that person's sexuality. That essentially, if it helps that longing toward wholeness, then one begins to get it cast into a perspective that's potentially ethical. Some interesting things here for any of you who may be in philosophy, can't find the philosophers on many campuses anymore. But you remember way back in ancient history, people like Spinoza and Kierkegaard argued quite hard for the fact that there was more to it than mind and body, that we had to postulate the concept of a self or of a soul, and that really psyche and soma were held together by some overarching principle that emerged with consciousness. and that somehow it was that self in its vital function that made the final judgment on whether sex, in any of its levels of manifestation, served the total good of the person. We, for example, are not able to say, my sexual needs require something. What we rather hope to be saying is, I desire to relate sexually with so-and-so. I think we also come to some agreement that a man's total self has its very existence in the community of other selves, and that the aim of human relationships, including sexual ones, is to foster self-respect on the one hand and mutual rights on the other. That without self-respect and mutual rights, one then uses the other for personal gratification. And this may indeed be the way it is in animal copulation, but it's hardly the way it needs to be, or I'd even add, ought to be, in human experience. I think we also come to some general agreement that the developmental aim of sex in human life is toward a progressive integration. And I emphasize developmental and progressive, for it seems to me one's only hypocritical to say that the kind of goals at 40 should be the ones at 20 or at 12. Somewhere one has to taste it, experience it, suffer it, know its defeat and its success, and then regroup if he's ever to be true to something that grows out of his nature. We have lots of data to tell us that no one can for long be true to what someone else wants him to be anyhow. Sooner or later, all that exists outside falls by the wayside. I think we do see, though, for example, that biologically sex reduces tension. This is the level that some begin at and never go beyond. I think we have lots of evidence to tell us that psychologically, sexual experience lets us find unsuspected aspects of our selfhood. When she says, in effect, being with you has introduced me to a whole new dimension of myself that I never dreamt existed. This indeed is the language of the soul and the poetry of ultimate truth. And she's saying that in a way you've given to me a gift which is more than a functional discharge, you see, of your sperm into me. That's a simple, we ought not to get so enamored with it. What she's really saying is that through you, I've, as it were, held a mirror held up that outlines for me, to be sure sometimes in shadowy form, aspects of my selfhood that very much need to be realized if all that I am is to multiply and to grow and to be rich. And he may well say the same thing using his own language. I think we also know that socially, in sexual experience, we discover depth in another, and by implication, the potential depth of all human beings. In clinical work, it's very simple for us to begin to see where potential schizophrenic patterns are when someone talks about how his sexual experience has isolated him further and further. For indeed, knowing that we have sisters and brothers wherever we have other human beings is not, I think, unrelated to our capacity for sexual experience. I think we find also there's a fourth thing, though, that, that really ethically we find in sexuality the real hard core of the dilemma between fulfillment and responsibility. And for me, anyhow, theologically in sexual experience, there's always the potential of the ultimate mystery, whose meaning's only partly revealed. We say this in normal words, but to me they have amplification that's endless. Often the couple says, it seems as if we were transported beyond anything that could be imagined. Well, you see, to be transported beyond is not to go to heaven where the streets are paved with gold. It's to go beyond the limits of our humanity. It's to somehow realize that time and space are tyrants, that in the deepest experiences do not determine all that's profound. It's sort of to get us out of that awful stimulus-response bond and out of causality, which is a trap. It's not saying, why did it happen? It's rather saying, what's its purpose? That somehow begins to let the flow that makes for the richness of the human take place. Well, I think, as I've said, separating sex from the rest of the self is no more tenable than it would be to isolate one's larynx and speak of one's vocal cords wanting to talk with a friend. And yet in this new kind of puritanism, this is often the way that I hear it talked about and put. Evil and good, therefore, I think, are not to be found in the body as such, or what one does with it, but in rather how the self relates itself to the bodily function. Well, what can we go on and say? I have a second section. I'd like to skip some of the written material and let you again read it if you want to later, and say, let's take a few observations about sexuality that I haven't read in the other papers, that are controversial, that I think an analyst with a theological training ponders. I note, for example, how the sexual impulse is impossible to confine to the person possessing the urge. It always seeks the partner, unless we've got a neurosis or an emerging kind of psychosis or a compulsive kind of masturbation problem on our hands. There seems to be something in the very structure of sexuality itself that points toward a partner or toward a two-way kind of communication. This suggests all sorts of things. You see, it suggests active as well as passive response. You don't just take it. If you just take it, you again are reduced to the thing level. To receive actively is indeed one of the great attributes of the human being. Creatureliness implies that one is always challenged to transcend nature, to take what's natural and make it, if you will, supernatural, speaking symbolically now, is indeed to me the task of becoming more totally human. So I see something in the very nature of human sexuality as I listen to it, as I observe it, as I read the literature, but most of all as I look at the laboratory of myself, for I'd not want to stand outside. I'd want to look from within with all the subjective limits that produces. I see something in the nature of sexuality that prohibits me from merely letting go and having my fling irrespective of what's on the other side. For my sexuality without a partner reduces my selfhood. So the theme of human communication is an inevitable and inescapable aspect of the most exciting physical act. I think also, to say a second thing about sexuality, that sexual knowledge for me is quantitatively different from knowledge about sex. See, there's a very special kind of knowledge that goes with sexual knowledge. Interesting, you know, in the Old Testament it said that Adam knew Eve, which implies that he had sexual knowledge about her. At least sexual knowledge is existential. It's accessible from the inside. It's not so much the description of bodily function and organs, which may be important, but it's rather that you've had the capacity to carry your own suffering, to know your own anxiety about success or failure, that beyond the measurements of the partner, that something about what takes place in a sexual experience you've conceptualized and made it your own, that you carry it with you. When someone goes from sensation to sensation, sexual knowledge escapes him, even though certain kind of experiences he's had in multitude. My sad-looking young friend last night, I suspect, has lots of stickers on his airplane cover. But those kinds of victories are, in the long run, not victories. They really point to the fruitless spinning of his wheels. For to turn an event into an experience is the mandate, I think, of wholeness. Interesting to note also, if I might digress a minute, that somehow we've done with death in this new Puritanism, I think the same kind of thing we've done with sex. We've got it separated off from the total legacy of the human being. So we have the cosmetic of death and the ridiculous expense and the sweet by-and-by high-priced lot and all of those things which sort of deny this. You remember Bruce Marshall, who's outdated now, he wrote back in the 30s, he has a marvelous passage about death, seeing it from the Spanish Civil War time. He says, down in the street, the municipal hearse flashed by on one of its many daily journeys to the cemetery. From the high windows, the naked corpse lying in the unlidded coffin looked like a doll in a cardboard box. There were no mourners and no priests, no hope, no despair, no mystery. Everything was simple and clear. Life meant something only because it meant nothing. See, I'm saying if you reduce a person to his functions, then the threat of meaninglessness always raises its head. But I think there's some other things. Let me mention two or three. There are some fundamental differences in sexuality as we observe it operationally in a male and a female that I think always have bearing on ethical decision making. Certainly the woman reveals herself in sexuality more than does a man. At least in the early years, If a man still holds himself back later, then a young fool has become an old fool. And that's the tragedy of many a man. That with the passage of time, he still functions sexually the way he began. And if she only sees herself later as the receiver and the mother and the protector and the active or passive responder, then she's cheated herself. And a young wench ends up becoming an old witch, to make it with a play on words. Well, I think we also note that the seduction of a girl psychologically means something totally different than what happens to a man. We don't speak of a seduction of a man, at least we don't back where I come from. You may have that problem with the aggressive females out here on this campus. Kierkegaard one time said that it would matter nothing to him to betray the whole world, but that he would shrink from betraying a pure maiden, for this would mean that one was violating the self of that maiden. And now beyond physiology, I'm saying there's something about what comes from the feminine capacity that ought to be a model for the man, even as his aggressiveness and discharge should be for her. But at least in the beginning stages, where I'm zeroing in, there are differences here that produce some of the problems in the double standard. And they're buried deep in the nature of human nature and are very stubborn to change. I think also, for example, that the woman is by and large oriented monogamously. Any generalization is false. I've met lots of women in the counseling room that tell me they're not oriented monogamously, and that I ought to stop that. Nonsense. But certainly a man is not by nature monogamous. He's by nature polygamous. Lots of data that we could use to substantiate that, and I amplify this in the paper. For our purposes here, I'm simply trying to say that then the problem in the double standard, which is more than sexual, and you know this better than your parents do, and I was reminded forcibly this morning that young people didn't think that sex was the only thing in the world. And then when we talked about double standards, we meant such things as vocation. I mean, a woman's destiny as a person ought not to be synonymous with their vocation as a mother and wife. Certainly, we don't think a man's destiny as a man is tied up with his role as father and husband. We think he has a task. And in the whole feminine mystique, this is a long overdue updating to take place. Certainly, it's wrong for a man to have money and a woman only to have it when he gives it to her. Yet it's amazing how many husbands don't set up separate bank accounts where she controls it and spends it or hoards it or gives it away, but that it's hers. We miss the significance of that kind of independence in the double standard bit. But in the sexual realm, I think as such, you see, the trouble is that a man is only a man if he thinks of himself in relation to a woman. No profit in being a man if I don't know the opposite sex, as I'm able to perceive it. Now, if the nature of the woman is over a period of time violated and reduced, as I perceive it to be, by promiscuity, then you see my manhood has to be considered in relation to her womanhood. And if the nature of her womanhood demands something other than what is natural for me, then I have to begin to see my manliness not as a young buck or as an old horse, but rather as a human being who seeks to relate significantly to another human being. So that finally, and I think this is a process move, I don't find many guys who begin their sexual life being monogamous, nor do I want to knock it if some here have. You know, you're always in that kind of a problem. But I think the growth toward a serious consideration of a lifetime of responsibility to another, for me, comes not out of prudishness or what I learned in Sunday school or in Puritan Boston where I grew up. It comes out of the nature of a man and the nature of a woman. Well, I think some other things I note that I'd like to comment on. These are very simple things, but they're out of the clinical experience, where we live it and see it rather than where we read it and sort of publish it. It's obvious, and you've read this and heard this with mother lecturers, that much of the time it's not the behavior but the attitude behind the behavior that causes the problem. Lots of so-called sexual problems, as you know, are brought to us because they're problems of identity, of affection. Everybody needs affection and tenderness, lots of people can decide when it's appropriate to have sexual experience. But if affection and tenderness have been denied for the long growing up years, and particularly I think in relation to girls, if fathers have been out of it, and then are so stupid when she weeps or breaks down to say, "Haven't I always given you everything you wanted?" Meaning clothing allowances and budgets and options on schools. We see that the young adult who so much wants to recapture what she knows she missed begins to think that this might come by momentary closeness, that it produces a fundamental alienation from her own growing edge. I must report and wish that I couldn't sometimes, but that's the way we observe it. We know other things that come under the guise of sexuality are in there, and you can't be too simple. We know, for example, that the power of sexuality is not always tied up to pleasure. It's tied up to that longing for union that is to be made whole. We know also that it's hard for some to separate sexual attraction from personal love. No matter how deeply one loves another, one's sexual attraction, as I'm able to see it, goes on through a lifetime. And that the deeper the love sometimes, the more heightened is the sexual attraction to other people. The sexual attraction and personal love don't cancel each other out. We know also that the ability to hold a sexual fantasy and not always have to act on it is what leads to true freedom psychologically. If every desire and fantasy demands action, then one is possessed by his instincts. And to put his instincts in the service of his selfhood is magnificent. To be their prisoner, it seems to me, is to be forever held at one level of existence. Well, we also know that anxiety and the fear that one's not going to become somebody until he proves himself, he gets behind lots of sexuality. We see lots of young businessmen in the clinic in New York, where we see 500 people a week, which gives me a fair sense of the cross-section. What goes on, who are so constantly talking about their potency that I'm suspicious that clinically somewhere they're afraid of being impotent. And not only in their physical capacity, but in whatever it means to be man and to be masculine. Well, there are lots of other things. We know that aggressiveness and hostility is much involved in sexual experience. That thin line, as you know, between the pain that produces light, delight, and the pain that produces separation and masochism. Must be a better word, but masochism is not far away in love play. We also know that sexual activity activates the demonic side. There is a kind of noble tragedy in fine sexual experience. I think we're so inundated with this living happily ever after bit that to know the depth as well as the height we sometimes avoid, and this again I think makes it hollow and sometimes insignificant. Jungian psychotherapy, we call this the shadow factor. Now we know that while the shadow often appears as something destructive and powerful, it also harbors the roots of warmth and creativity and relatedness. A wicked man, with a subtle, slight twist of his response, becomes a warm, sensitive man. The woman who is the witch all of a sudden becomes the delightful creature for which he'll slay the dragon and go through the forest. What I'm saying is that in any sexual experience, one has to deal with the moral question, the inner darkness, or if you will, in my language, the shadow. And knowing one's own shadow or evil and taking responsibility for it rather than projecting it outward not only saves one from the seduction of the innocent, which incidentally contaminates a man his whole life through, even though it doesn't affect him like it does the woman who is his victim. Because every alternative produces a consequence. And so often in life, we want the alternative and try to avoid the consequence. My observation is that it doesn't work. We also note some other things when we talk about sexual experience. We note from where I sit that one of the deep longings of every man is to find the feminine principle. See, and the feminine principle is the principle of relatedness, of warmth, of giving birth to, of caring for, of going to the garden, of knowing something about the earth. See, the masculine principle, which every woman longs for, wants to go to the moon, not to the garden. It is the principle of discrimination and criticism, of power, while the feminine principle is the one of love. Now, we sometimes call that the anima and the animus, that it takes four. There's a man in every woman and a woman in every man. Often in the beginning, and sometimes tragically throughout life, one only sees these principles at work in external people. But you see, no woman externally can become a substitute for my developing my own inner feminine capacity. It has nothing to do with being effeminate. Let's always plug that one in. It has something to do with the floods of my own warmth. And really, no matter how good a provider or father I may be, when the woman says to the child, "Speak to your father," she says more about her relationship to that man than about the child's. But you see, he can only carry that projection for so long. For sooner or later, if she's going to be total and full, then she has to discover her own capacity for discrimination, for forceful decision making, for going from opinionatedness to sound decision making. And we know how in marriage we often marry someone who carries this inferior side of us, our underdeveloped side. And one of the great joys of marriage, if you stay in it long enough, is that you may come to the place where you no longer carry your mate's inferior side, but you love them enough so they develop it in themselves. And then the whole mix gets shaken up again, and it's as if you were beginning all over again. One of the delightful things that only continuity can lead us into. You know how this appears. Remember the situation when the man wanted to kiss the woman and she said, "Do you love me?" And he says, "How on earth do I know until I've kissed you?" Such is the difference between the masculine and the feminine principle. Well, there's one other thing that strikes me in the consulting room, and that is that in any talk about sexual experience where I'm involved, we quickly somehow always get to the parents. Not only to the Mrs. Robinsons, wherever they exist, but the parent images are very powerful. And often sexual experience is either an attempt to deny or to cling to the parental image. Some of us are persuaded that behind the flesh and blood parents are, of course, the archetypal parents, the great mother and the great father. And in psychological maturity, that's the toughest battle one has to fight. For the man to get free from the great mother, it had nothing to do with slamming the gate on his earth mother. Something to do with his ability to succor himself, to heal his own wound, to provide his own creativity. And for the woman, it's not walking out on father or repudiating him by marrying a boy he can't stand. It's rather ultimately beginning to relate to power, because power and love belong together. Well, we also find yet one other thing, and that is that there's always behind erotic involvement some real desire for possessiveness. It's amazing how we hear this over and over again. The unconscious wishes that the mate should become one's exclusive property. We know how in marriage, and I think the critics of the institution are quite right, that in marriage one of the awful things has been the assumption that she's my property. And the warning against adultery in the Old Testament was, by and large, don't tamper with my property. But this goes both ways. The woman wants the man as her exclusive property and vice versa. And really, at the best, one should only be one's own property. Whenever you take me for granted, to put it in other language, then that which holds us together has gone out the window. But I think this works both ways. A guy cannot ask for promiscuity and freedom for himself and read the Riot Act when she talks about the nice man that she met at the cocktail party. The exclusiveness tied up with eroticism is really one of the potentially disintegrating attributes that's in sexuality. Well, the soul is the only four-letter word that's not in very much. And I've said, for me, soul is a construct. It's a capacity of the self. And it always lets us do at least four things. When one finds his soul, and I think the metaphor is worthy of not rejecting too quickly. You want to find the woman with soulful eyes. And it'd be a great idea to look at a great old soul and go and talk quietly to him in the spring or the autumn. and to have a soulful experience, as the writers of some of our new music tell us. It's sort of beyond pleasure and pain. But for example, soul helps us turn events into experiences. You see, you keep repeating the same old event only until it becomes an experience. And the fruitless pursuit of one more conquest after another, or going out for one more good time after another until you're fatigued and depleted, this comes because somehow one doesn't turn the event into an experience that he can savor and hold and keep. One fundamental experience lasts a long time. Were there time, I could tell you anecdote after anecdote of people in unbelievable long separations and hardships, and some of us in the war, and the difference between people who only knew events and who turned events into experience is one of the radical differences in the human potential. Well, the soul also makes meaning possible. I said it's really not how many times did you do it, but what does it mean to you? It's not why are you this way, but what's the purpose of this behavior that we now engage in? And to not dare to raise the question of purpose is to not dare to be human. The soul also communicates in love, whatever the slipperiness of that word is, and I don't like it either, but it does imply relatedness. And it does imply that I care enough about you not to use you to gratify my personal desire. And it does imply revealing and not concealing. No tricks, no stunts, you know, no intrigue that goes well for very long. And soul always implies a religious dimension in the sense of mystery, not in the sense of dogma and churchiness. In the sense that the connuntio, which is what the alchemists in the Middle Ages talked about, that the union of the opposites does shake the mountains, does bring forth new streams, and does grow up new flowers, and does put its silver streams across the night sky. That kind of mystery. The reason the temple prostitute and prostitution and religion have hung together in spite of our attempt to separate them is that in the finest moments of a sexual experience, there are remarkable parallels to what take place at the deepest moments of a spiritual I-thou encounter. Again, I wish someday you'd have a section on the mythology of the virgin and the prostitute. You see, the virgin symbolically and in mythology, a very important creature. When any man finds the inner woman, so he no longer needs lots of playgirls outside, this is always a contrasexual union. So to be virgin in the best sense had nothing to do with being married. It rather had something to do with that which went beyond law and with on the physical. And the continuance of the Virgin and the Blessed Mother in one of our great churches, from a psychological standpoint, to me is fundamental. And no desire to debate its theological ramifications. Even as the prostitute in dreams and fantasies, clinically, is always a tremendously exciting figure to appear. Now, if the man interprets that he ought to go out and find Irma LaDuce or some such person, he's always doomed to failure, because the prostitute, in fact, has succumbed to promiscuity and therefore has denied her selfhood. So is he, if it happens to be a male prostitute. But what we can't dare to look for in the flesh, we dare not avoid in the spirit. Well, in conclusion, let me add the 4 minutes up that are left. And those of us with me here, I don't know where you are out in the other room, are so quiet, I'm afraid they're asleep. Like somebody to wiggle their toes or move their fingers. I'd like to say something about marriage. A good word for it, if possible. Certainly marriage can be either holy wedlock or what somebody called unholy deadlock. But it seems to me that in many respects, marriage is more important than sex. I wouldn't want to be pushed too far on that or in certain occasions, but within a structure, sometimes love alone grows. There is a uniqueness in relationship that potentially marriage, I think, can produce. As we look at the future, there's some exciting things. All this we've left out, and you've read it other times. I mean, the pill, the encounter groups, the demand for affective education as opposed to content input, the fact that some parents are now coming around to think that to be a good person is more important than to figure out what it is to be a good parent, that in some families the accent's gone from obedience to understanding, that critiquing each other in the family with candor is now taking place in a multitude of very healthy units that never get to the clinician and therefore become his bizarre data upon which he generalizes and gets all of us caught in the same trap. All this is very exciting and taking place. But I think, for example, we do note that where we have covenant as a word as opposed to contract, which always has an escape clause, then the issue is not trust and betrayal, but what you do with them when they take place. And that the whole idea behind the archaic statement of for better or worse takes on new meaning. And I'm persuaded that those who survive the experiments and the trial marriages finally settle for a covenant kind of relationship that really is magnificently beyond what I knew 20 years ago when we were dealing with this. So I have great respect for some of the results I see from data that often is confusing and to me highly ambivalent and bewildering. I think we note also that really there seems to be a public character in marriage. You know, in a way, when the Pope argued with Henry VIII, at least I agree that Henry had no right to do something with disregard for everybody else. And when Abe Lincoln's folks got together, they produced a boy who set the stage for a whole new history. Marriage in the future, I think, will say a great deal about vocation of parenthood. And probably in 20 years, nobody will have children naturally. At birth, they'll be introduced chemicals into the body that will make it possible to reproduce, unless an aggressive self-conscious act which demands reversal of that which will be begun in the baby takes place. I think this means that baby making and love making will then get together not by accident, but really by conscious self-determination. And as men find that building skyscrapers has limits and leads to questionable results, and that the vocation of fatherhood leads to enriching personal possibilities, the vocation of parenthood will not be seen as bottles and diapers, although they'll be around, I think, for better or worse, but it will be seen as that way of relating that sets free the child that seeks to be born in every adult. And somehow these, I think, will come close together. Well, in conclusion, it seems to me that what I've been trying to say is that the greatest thing going for ethical decision-making is the nature of human nature. See, I see human nature desperately wanting to be responsible unless it's been bruised and distorted and denied what's rightfully its own place. It seems to me that the soul requires that we become more than like our animal ancestors. It seems to me that in the whole sexual puritanism of the moment, there exists a magnificent possibility of turning it into something that will enrich human life like it's never been enriched before. The old mistress, in writing to the young wife, to pick up one more of her paragraphs, put it this way: any attempt to wring from a situation proof that it is or is becoming falsifies it. She's speaking of a sexual encounter. It ceases to be a relationship, a meeting, and it becomes any of 100 other things, a demand for reassurance, laziness, stubbornness, tyranny, all kinds of things. No one is so serene and so detached as never to need some approbation, but blackmailing it from love does violence to affection without really satisfying the other longing. Chicanery has never produced a shred of genuine response, which is what the heart wisely hungers for. The paltry soul fears that its ramshackle building will be blown away in the storm of living. The bold nature shouts in the teeth of the gale, glad to be hammered into shape and purpose, that it may discover what it's made of. The cautious hedge themselves about with customs and plans and prefabricated divisions and appeal to experts to certify that what they do is really living. But life is a deeper process, filled with the highly charged winds of paradox and truth and transfiguration, a willingness for tears and a sense of ending. Don't pretend you want love if what you truly want is safety. Like the kitten who stalks its mother's tail, knowing it's really not a dragon's tail at all, and at worst it will get cuffed and then washed and warmed and fed. I'm persuaded that most humans are not like the kitten that chases the mother cat. And to that extent, sex and the soul are to me related. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Dr. Maxfield. I think I can speak for our group that in presenting our 19th All-University Lecture, you have helped translate an event into an experience for which we sincerely thank you. We find it necessary to affirm a decision made earlier that it will not be possible for dialogue following the presentation due to a rather incredible schedule that our speakers follow. The next step this evening will be to meet with residence groups for meals and then to come back at 7 o'clock this evening. We hope that you will stay with us and to use the phrasing that Dr. Maxfield began with to help us close the mind gap as we examine the ethical and moral considerations in decision making. Thank you for coming.